This is a republic if you can keep it. An inside look at Michigan and national politics, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
They call him Flipper, Flipper, faster than lightning. No one you see is smarter than he. And we know Flipper lives in a world full of wonder, flying there under the sea.
I'm Mark Brewer. Welcome to the Flipper edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It. In Georgia, three of Donald Trump's attorneys have flipped, pleading guilty, getting no jail time, but agreeing to testify against the 15 remaining defendants, including Trump himself, in that state's RICO conspiracy case. In Washington, Trump's chief of staff, former Congressman Mark Meadows, has reportedly also flipped in exchange for immunity from federal charges. And boy, does he have all the inside information. And in Michigan, one of the accused faked electors has also flipped in the prosecution brought by Attorney General Dana Nessel, which is very bad news for the remaining 15 defendants, including, among others, former state Republican co-chair LeSean Maddock.
I'm Jeff Timmer. In Washington, House Republicans have set the stage for flipping control back to the Democrats in 2025. By a unanimous vote of the Republican Conference, the GOP has entered into a 100% MAGA mode, fully under the thumb of Donald Trump, as a virtually unknown backbencher becomes the least qualified and potentially most dangerous Speaker of the House in a century. In other news, Michigan's two top universities are mired in scandals growing out of athletics, scandals that could topple MSU's board chair and U of M's football coach, and maybe even the concept of the boards that run those two schools. North Carolina's latest gerrymander virtually guarantees Republican control of a 50-50 state by making legislative and congressional elections almost irrelevant. Georgia legislators are ordered to make their maps a little less skewed. Justice Clarence Thomas is back in the news again for all the wrong reasons. Another favor from a friend who forgave Thomas's motor home loan out of the goodness of his heart. And Michigan legislators are finally grappling with implementing the anti-corruption disclosure legislation that some are calling half-hearted. These are the requirements necessitated by the passage of Proposal 1 in the 2022 election. We'll talk with one of those critics, Nick Pidgeon of the nonpartisan Michigan Campaign Finance Network. But Mark, let's begin. And you've got some news related to petitions and issues here in Michigan that's it's been in the news and there's about to be a new development. Why don't you fill us in?
So I represent a group that's been gathering petition signatures to raise the minimum wage in Michigan to $15 an hour, index it for inflation, and extend it to all workers in Michigan, get rid of all these exceptions, particularly the abusive exception for tipped workers. We have faced no end of obstacles from employers in the state. About a year and a half ago, they objected to the petition because it had a union label on it. The Michigan Supreme Court made short work of that. The petition was incredibly popular, Jeff. We gathered nearly 600,000 signatures in less than 5 months. And we were before the Board of Canvassers last week. The staff said there's enough signatures here, board certify. And yet the board again does what it often does, unfortunately, it deadlocks. It finds some lame excuse not to certify. This is a petition where the summary's been approved by that board, the petition's been approved by that board, and now we have enough signatures, but yet they still won't certify. So we're going to be going directly to the Michigan Supreme Court in the near future to ask that court once again, tell this board, you're way beyond your authority here. There's enough signatures, certify this thing. If that happens, Jeff, it'll go to the legislature. The legislature will have a chance to adopt this. But if that doesn't happen, the voters will have a chance to vote on it in 2024. It's been a long battle, and the employers have used every legal trick they can think of to try to stop this. But so far, we're on track, and we're hoping to get some relief in the Michigan Supreme Court.
You'd be hard-pressed to find two people, Mark, who have more experience combined than you and I when it comes to dealing with the Board of Canvassers. You with all your practice before there, me with issues before the board. I've sat on the board for a number of years. Has there ever been any discussion, or maybe it's time to start it, that when the board goes beyond, it exceeds its scope of authority and forces groups to go spend money, is this time to consider some kind of financial penalty for the board if they fail to live up to their duty? That's something that would have motivated us when I sat on the board, if there was a real penalty to playing these political games.
Jeff, it's interesting that you should raise that, because one of the issues I am researching is, as part of our complaint, asking for some kind of sanctions for the payment of my client's attorney's fees, damages, costs. I mean, now that may not be assessed personally against the board members, but at least it would represent, as you just indicated, some kind of disincentive, because this keeps happening. It's happened to my clients now twice in this petition drive. We saw it with the Reproductive Freedom petition drive, where they tried to stall that from the ballot because the alleged spacing between some words was off. And the tone of the Michigan Supreme Court orders in these cases have been increasingly abrupt and short with the Board of Canvassers. I'm going to lead my complaint by saying they're at it again, because the court unfortunately has had to deal with this. But again, I hope and plan to make a request for some kind of financial sanctions here, because this has got to stop. Jeff, I really want to spend a little bit of time, I know there's been a lot of press attention on already, talking about Mike Johnson. Our listeners are going to say, Mike who? As you mentioned in your opening remarks, this backbencher, who is apparently the least offensive possibility for speaker, but now is the least experienced speaker in decades, if not a century, and one of the most ideological and conservative, endorsed by Trump, anti-choice, anti-LGBTQ. He was one of the leading theorists and lawyers of the election denial stuff that went on January 6th. Apparently, Matt Gaetz and Boebert and the rest of them finally found a speaker candidate, and the moderate Republicans just rolled over, Jeff. And it's terrible. I think they stood up at least a few rounds of voting against prior candidates, but they just now have seemed to be resigned to this guy. What do you think?
I think we need to put the focus of this conversation not on the process. The process, I saw people on cable news last night applauding, at least the House is back functioning again, as if that was the goal, regardless of who's in charge of it. I think who's in charge of it matters. And this guy is very scary. Adam Kinzinger, former Republican congressman, retired in 2022, didn't run for reelection in Illinois, called Mike Johnson Jim Jordan in drag. He is much less personally offensive and personally well-known than Jim Jordan, but every bit is extreme and radical and dangerous and much more of the theological wing of the party. Jamie Raskin, a Democratic congressman from Maryland, said on Twitter that if Mike Johnson was watching The Handmaid's Tale, he would not be rooting for June to win. This is the kind of figure steeped in religion. And there's enough oppo out there that has already in the last 24 hours been hitting social media and the airwaves about this guy and his thoughts on the United States is not a democracy. It's a biblical republic, is the quote that he uses on film just a couple of years ago. There's a fundamental difference between his attitudes toward religion and government and the way that they mix that I think is going to be kryptonite for the Republicans in marginal districts. I saw John James, Michigan's very vulnerable Republican congressman from Macomb and Oakland County, say on Twitter that he cast his vote for Mike Johnson and was proud to do so. And I said, see me next November and let me know how that works out for you, sport, because I think that is going to put the John Jameses of the world in Michigan and marginal congressmen, Republicans in New York and California and across the country, they're going to have to spend the next year defending the extremism far outside the mainstream of American, where American voters are. The vast majority of American voters do not share the extreme, very radical positions of Mike Johnson. And this may be a blessing in disguise for partisan Democrats and their candidates running next year. This may have assured what already looked likely, and that was that Democrats were likely to flip control of the U.S. House. This may have guaranteed it.
Yeah, it's interesting the point you make about John James, because this Johnson guy is on the record, and he regularly calls for cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. I can tell you, as a Macomb County resident, that's not going to play well with our senior citizens. Michigan's an older state. Macomb County is one of the older counties, and we have a lot of folks dependent on Medicare and Social Security. And John James just walked right into that. I noticed today, Jeff, and back to Johnson for a second, that they asked him about the shootings in Maine. And no disrespect to religion intended by what I'm about to say, he said, we need to pray. Well, that's true, but we need more than thoughts and prayers. But that's where he stopped. That's where he stopped. And I think, unfortunately, that's what we're going to see. I think he's in the school of shut the government down. We don't want any more continuing resolutions. We want to renege on the deal that was cut between McCarthy and Biden when it came to the debt ceiling and the budget last year. So I know everybody's optimistically talking. Biden has said, I look forward to working with him. McConnell and Schumer said the same thing. But I think, again, the right wingers, the Marjorie Taylor Greens, the Boberts, Matt Gaetz has got exactly the guy that they want who's going to do for them what McCarthy would.
In Michigan, Mark, we've talked about this on some past episodes, the prospect of, instead of university, the people on university boards at Michigan State University and the University of Michigan running for statewide election and very low profile, low information elections, moving those positions to gubernatorial appointments with the advice and consent of the Senate. And the universities, through different scandals and infighting, some of which has been publicized a tremendous amount and some has come to light after the fact, have seemed to throw some gas on a fire, creating an impetus for this. And there's some serious talks about this. What would it take in order for that to happen? Is that something that could happen statutorily? Would that require a constitutional change? What would have to happen?
I believe that would require a constitutional change, Jeff. And I got to say, that would be unfortunate. I think it's been good overall for Michigan to have these universities run by these independent boards. They've generally done a good job. I'm not trying to defend what's been going on at MSU the last several years, but these board members are bringing this on themselves by showing that they are incapable of governing in the way that they should. And it's going to end up, I think, hurting the voters. I think the voters should have a voice in who runs these universities. And like I said, I think by and large, the system has worked, but it's getting so bad, particularly at MSU, that you're right. There are serious discussions going on about amending the state constitution and making those boards subject to gubernatorial appointment. I think that opens us up to other abuses, patronage appointments and the like. We see that already at a number of the other universities and colleges in the state which are subject to gubernatorial appointment. There have been some terrible appointments there. But again, these boards are playing right into the hands of their enemies when they show that they are incapable of governing.
We've also seen some movement in the last week on one of our familiar topics, gerrymandering around the country. North Carolina, is their Republican legislature is taking serious steps now, enacting plans just 2 years into the existing plans that didn't turn out the way that the Republicans who control the legislature there wanted. They've already cut the governor out of the process, the Democratic governor. They're looking at midterm gerrymandering. Georgia has now been ordered by federal courts to change their plans. Alabama is in the process of having a federal master redo their congressional plans. Louisiana's plans are going to be changed. Is it normal to see this kind of activity still going on?
No, it's not. And it's and even outside the Deep South, we're just a few days away here from a trial in Michigan over our legislative districts in the Detroit area. We've talked about that before. Wisconsin. There's talk there with the shifted control of the Supreme Court of litigation over their legislative districts. New York, the Democrats there are trying to recover from the debacle of 2022, their redistricting plan and inattention to politics, which led to Republicans winning several otherwise Democratic seats. The governor's sister may be involved in some of those efforts. So it's not just the Deep South where a lot of these Voting Rights Act cases are going. And as I sit here, it's hard for me to judge what's going to be the overall balance. Democrats might pick up a seat in Alabama. they're going to lose several congressional seats in North Carolina. It looks like they're going to go from even, I think it's 7-7, so probably as bad as 11-3 or maybe even 12-2. So they're going to lose a lot of seats there. They may pick up a seat in Louisiana, Georgia, who knows. But I think a part of this is, Jeff, the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, let all this loose on folks when they refused a few years ago to take up the issue of gerrymandering and establish a national pattern. But again, I think the other big factor is the country is so closely divided, right? Congress hinges on 4 or 5 races. Many of these legislatures around the country are close. And so you're going to see these continuing battles as people continue to use every legal tool and political tool they've got as bodies change power to redo this. I'm worried about what I would call mid-decade redistricting. And as legislatures flip back and forth over the course of the next decade, in most states, there is no restraint on a new legislature undoing the legislative plans on which it was elected. Sadly, we may be in an era, Jeff, where this is not a once-a-decade fight. It's a continuing fight throughout a decade.
Is the newly introduced ethics package enough for Michigan? The head of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network offers his thoughts after these messages on a republic, if you can keep it.
One thing I have learned in politics, not all pollsters are equal. There are a lot of bad polls and a small number of good ones. That's why Epic MRA stands out. Epic MRA has been measuring Michigan public opinion for more than 4 decades. The company has earned a national reputation for integrity and accuracy. In fact, it is rated as the best polling company in Michigan by 538.com. The 2022 election is the latest example of why political professionals rely on Epic MRA. While a lot of other pollsters were calling the key races toss-ups, Epic MRA accurately reported that it looked like a Democratic sweep. And they also reported that the 3 ballot proposals would all win decisively, which is exactly what happened. It's not just politics. Epic MRA has been the go-to pollster for school districts, local governments, and independent groups who need to know what the public is thinking. If anyone asks me, I'm happy to recommend Epic MRA. For the best in public opinion research, head to epicmra.com.
Show your support for preserving our republic at the A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
With Michigan lawmakers finally taking up financial disclosure legislation required by the passage of Proposal 1 last year, there's no better time to talk to the head of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, Nicholas Pidgeon. MCFN is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization started in 1996 as a project of the nonprofit Michigan Prospect. From the beginning, the organization has focused on public education regarding the impact of money on politics in Michigan.
MCFN's work to assist the public in understanding the role that contributions politicians play is critical to the healthy operation of a democratic system of governance. The primary tools of this effort are transparent, timely and fact-based research and analysis made available to the general public, voters, policymakers, and those people in organizations who are attempting to shape public policy. Since December of last year, Nick Pidgeon has served as the executive director and chief researcher.
Welcome to our podcast. You lead an incredibly important organization in Michigan, one that we've looked to for a long time for analysis on campaign finance, lobbying, and lots of other topics. Today, we want to focus on the breaking news that in the state legislature, we now have legislation to implement Prop 1. And you've been in the middle of that. I know you've already testified. And so we want to get your take on all the legislation that's been introduced. Maybe you could help us work our way through what's been introduced and what MCFN position is on it.
Sure. And thanks for having me tonight, gentlemen. This story is ever evolving. After my testimony at the Senate Oversight Committee yesterday, we see 2 more packages come out. One late yesterday from the House, which has more stringent requirements than the Senate bill's package. And then we see late today, another House package from a different set of House members come out, and it mirrors a lot what the Senate's package looks like. So this story is ever evolving. I've been trying to keep track of it myself.
Why don't you, for us and our listeners, why don't you tell us what's in the first introduced package, the Senate package, and give us your analysis. I think, as I recall, you were critical in your testimony, but tell us what's in that package and what your concerns are.
Sure. What I see my role here at the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, I look at what all other states have in their personal financial disclosure law. And we have 48 states who have already put this law through, a lot of them starting in the 70s. And it's only Michigan and Idaho who don't currently have a public official personal financial disclosure law on the books currently. I just wanted to compare and give the committee some information about how this prospective law stacks up to the rest of the countries. There are some things that are really strong. For instance, a lot of other states don't require this financial disclosure law to candidates. They only require it of sitting public officials. Michigan's law goes above and beyond what Prop 1 mandated, that this also extends to people seeking candidates. There's a $1,000 threshold for people to have to report a source of earned and unearned income. And that is the usual minimum threshold that states have. Some are higher, some are lower. But in the Senate's package and in the House package that was introduced later today, it doesn't seem that they'll have to report the actual amount of money that they get from the different sources. They'll just have to describe the nature of the name of the organization, the nature of it, without reporting in categorical terms or in the actual discrete number how much they make from that source of income. There was a House bill introduced by a Republican member way earlier in the year, in March, where there was a categorical disclosure of these sources of earned and unearned income. So it was interesting to see that. In all the packages on the table, the requirement of disclosure of securities is a strong one. In other states, sometimes that just isn't even in their personal financial disclosure law. Michigan's would be pretty stringent, but there was, in the Senate package, the qualifier that they wouldn't have to disclose a fund if it was widely diversified. That's a quote. And it's unsure how widely diversified a fund would have to be for it to escape disclosure. Could it be in one sector? And you can see what I'm going with that. The big hot topic when it comes to the difference between the package we see when I testified at the Senate Oversight Committee and the package that came out later yesterday from representatives like Representative Skaggs, Representative Burns, is the disclosure of the filer's spouse's income and assets. What's really interesting is in the Senate's package, they would describe the occupation of the spouse and they wouldn't have to describe or even disclose any of their assets if they didn't have control over it, it was just under the control of the spouse. I know that someone would testify at the same committee hearing, former Representative LeGrand kind of walked us through how an asset transfer could happen to a spouse that could absolve a public official of having to make such a disclosure. And I thought that was interesting that he brought context to that situation. What the package from Representative Burns and others from the House is much more stringent when it comes to spousal disclosure. It even extends it to immediate household family members, and they would have to disclose much of the same information, including securities, assets, their sources of earned and unearned income, as long as they're over $50,000. And so that would be, in comparison to other states, that'd be a pretty stringent requirement in Michigan's law.
Yeah, it's certainly known to our listeners the problems that we've seen in Michigan, criminality under investigation, former Speaker Lee Chatfield, activity related to former Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey, articles in the last week, again, about the former Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff and ties to Rick Johnson, former Republican Speaker who's heading off to federal prison for 5 years. In Rick's case, he arranged for his wife to receive his bribes, and that was disclosed in his guilty plea. It's very important that we do this right, not just get it done. And I've joined you in your concerns that this be very stringent, that it go beyond what Prop 1 calls for as the minimum assessment required. But I do understand how there needs to be some privacy, perhaps, as long as the source of income doesn't present a conflict of interest. And so I know that has been a concern that's been voiced. I don't know how disclosure can be adjusted to work, but certainly the criminality and the corruption that we've seen has involved spouses. And so I would really think it would be the wrong move for the legislature to leave spouses out of this altogether.
No, I think that's an interesting point. And that's something that a few representatives have spoken about, that there was a balance of interests there when they didn't want to go into sort of, it was a, how'd they put it? Voyeurism, that people could peer into every single aspect of a representative's life versus needing to have the information that people need to see that there's not a conflict of interest here in their personal finances, and that their package of bills, they leave that out, and that they balance those two poles.
It's interesting to see the public division here on this particular issue, because Secretary of State Benson has called for stronger disclosure regarding spouses. I see that today Governor Whitmer said, though, that she opposed that. And like you said, Nick, there's been this other package introduced in the House. It looks like it got sent to a committee where things go to die. And then the other package you referenced, I think, is what I would call the leadership package. It parallels what was introduced in the Senate. I think it's going to be interesting to see this. We don't see this very much, this public disagreement among Democrats generally, plus even in the legislature. Former Representative LeGrand was quite strong in his criticism. And Representative Skaggs, who introduced the other package that you mentioned, used to work for LeGrand. So I think there may be some connections there. I wanted to ask if I could, though, that's the spousal piece, and we'll see how that all plays out. But I think Jeff touched on this a little bit, but I want to make sure that I understand that none of these packages would require disclosure if a nonprofit or any other organization that's not a lobbyist paid for travel. So that none of the circumstances, the payments surrounding Chatfield would have to have been disclosed if any of these packages had been in place. Am I reading that right, Nick?
Yes, you are reading that. And that was something I testified about in that Senate Oversight Committee hearing. Look, what the law says right now is that gifts, honoraria, and travel payments and reimbursements will have to be disclosed from lobbyists and lobbyist agents registered under Michigan law. Those things are either illegal or they're already disclosed on the lobbyist end. What that does not include is what you were saying, travel payments and reimbursements made out of 501c4 nonprofit organizations' personal budgets. That's not disclosed on their side, because on a Form 990, it's an unitemized disclosure of the total amount spent on travel for public officials. So if it doesn't have to be disclosed on the representative side, it's just going to be left undisclosed. And I've spoken to a few representatives about this piece, and I know that Senator Moss and Strum, I guess it was yesterday now, mentioned that could be a part of future legislation potentially next year. And just knowing that the research that I've done, the network, I know that disclosure requirement of having disclosed travel payments and reimbursements are in other states' personal financial disclosure law, this law that's on the book, that's on the agenda here in Michigan. In my opinion, if that's going to be a part of Michigan's law, this would be the bill and the time that it would occur.
Nick, you and I are on the same page, and many of our listeners do follow me on Twitter and know that a couple of days ago, I took real issue with the fact that would not be included, that some of the Lee Chatfield extravagances and corruption would not be covered under the package. Vocally criticized the legislative Democrats. I'm going to honor my commitment to not divulge my sources, but I did hear from a couple of sources that I do trust that those will end up being put into statute. I've been assured that is the case by people I trust, and I'm going to lose my shit if they're lying to me. And I don't think that the people involved are going to want to risk the flamethrower that I have been known to launch at Republicans aimed at them, if they are in fact yanking my chain here in order to keep me quiet now while they're trying to pass this. And so I say that here, fire another shot across their bow to make sure that they know I'm paying attention and watching for what it's worth. I don't think they're going to make all their decisions based on what I will put on Twitter.
Nick, I want to raise another topic with you related here, and I apologize to our listeners, but these nuances are important. It also appears to me that the package would not require the disclosure of somebody who was in Senator Shirky's position. And full disclosure, Jeff and I were involved in a complaint against him, which is still pending in front of the Attorney General on criminal charges, potentially, where you had an elected official like Shirky raising hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, for a C4 associated with him that it looked like, at least to Jeff and I, he controlled and basically directed where the money went after he raised it. I think there is a provision that talks about if you are associated in some way, you're like a director or something like that, you sit on the board of a nonprofit, but Shirky didn't have any of those positions, right? But he was the boss of the C4s, just to be blunt about it. And I'm not sure, as I read the bill, that he would have to disclose his association with those C4s and what he was doing in connection with them. Okay, I respect the fact that you may not be able to opine on that. I'm just curious about that angle of it, because that's another way in which we've seen abuse of these C4s.
Mark, I will say that my same sources that told me to wait patiently to watch the Chatfield excesses be dealt with said the same thing with regard to the Shirky excesses. And so I am watching and concerned about the same things that you just mentioned there, and have been assured that those will be taken care of, if not at this moment, in the very near future.
All right, Jeff, it's on you. We're going to watch you very closely. And Nick, again, while we've got you, and this is great, I really appreciate the depth you're able to go here. One of the other criticisms we've heard is that the fines and penalties are too small. That basically there's an administrative process to enforce this. It's similar to what's under the Campaign Finance Act, which I think is fine. I think that's a good process. But the criticism has been that the fines are so small that basically it's the cost of doing business, and you can get away with evading your disclosure obligations because in the end, you're going to pay a small fine and you're going to get away with it. Did you offer any analysis of the fine and the penalty structure in these bills?
Absolutely. And of course, the sentence package is on the extreme low end of what other states have as their upper bound. The House's package probably is in the middle of the road. What makes this law interesting here in Michigan is that a lot of other states give the power of enforcing these laws maybe to an independent ethics body or a joint or single chambers ethics committee that can send this to an investigation. So it's not only a financial penalty, but there is potentially unseating at play. And I know that in one of the package of bills, there is the possibility of if you don't get this submitted, you won't get seated at your positions. I think that a financial penalty is one thing. Some people have criticized that maybe it's the cost of doing business. And I agree with you. People could eat that. They will have to come back and then, as the law reads, fix their form. But if fine is low, there could be the cat and mouse game with the limited resources of the Secretary of State's office, and they can eat the fine on one thing, keep disclose maybe one part of it, and then keep going until it's a matter of time and resources on the enforcement mechanism.
One of the criticisms that there's been of the Campaign Finance Act over the years is that not only the Secretary of State not have the resources to investigate, but they don't have subpoena power. They are completely reliant. And again, Jeff, I ran into this in our complaint against Shirky. They are completely reliant on voluntary disclosure. They can't go out and subpoena information and conduct a true investigation. As I glanced through these bills, and hopefully we'll be able to confirm it, I didn't see that they gave the Secretary of State subpoena power or the ability to enforce he or she, whoever the Secretary of State ended up being in the future. They're going to have staff to look at these, but they're also going to be reliant on private complaints. That almost seems like it's a chicken and egg problem. If you don't know what's missing, how do you complain about it kind of thing? What would you do if you were writing this bill? What would you do in terms of a penalty and investigation structure?
Of course, that's a tough question. One that I'm posed with at the network is people philosophically ask, why does disclosure matter in the end? Do people do anything with the information? Doesn't matter unless it's just outright banned. The network's position has always been that disclosure and giving information to the hands of Michiganders and voters, that's how they're best able to participate in democracy. So that alone, I feel, and having that information out there is just something that's good on its own. I know that a lot of other states, it's very hard, number one, for the public to even access these forms, and number two, be able to cross-check and make sure and find something that is complaint-worthy. It's a hard thing to deal with, and that's something that when you're in the campaign finance world, you're thinking about reforms, as people do, we're used to it in public policy where they might not necessarily be able to fix a problem, but you can make steps to alleviating some ills of it. And I think that this bill, putting that information out there and getting more information and being more transparent, is good on its own.
There's certainly been some articles in recent weeks, as I don't know what the source has been, but as occupations of spouses have somehow become public, and we've seen some press on that, I think there'll be great press interest to whatever information is able to come out. Do you think these bills meet the minimum required by Prop 1? Or is somebody going to be tempted to file a lawsuit if the Senate package becomes law and be able to say, you didn't comply with Prop 1. This is not good enough.
I certainly think at all the bills I've seen, they comply with Prop 1. MCFN has reported since the beginning of the year that if our legislature does pass a law that just meets the minimum requirements of Proposal 1, then it'll be a weak law compared to the rest of the country. But as far as a meeting, what Prop 1 says, it does.
So we'll go from worst in the country to just one of the worst. Is that a fair characterization, Nick?
Yes. I think that you're referencing the rankings from the Coalition for Integrity, and that we're 48 out of 50 for public integrity and transparency. And I think that it's really interesting. Michigan adopted a lot of the ethics reforms of the 70s. We have a full-time, particularly professionalized legislature who's large in comparison to the population of the state. And then on the other hand, we have an executive branch that can't be foilable. And then we have this transparency issue where we don't have this law for personal financial disclosure that only Michigan and Idaho have. I think that Michigan can be a leader here, as it has been in other areas. And I think there's a lot of changes on the horizon.
Will any of these changes include reforms to the Freedom of Information Act? Will they be extended to the legislature? Will they be extended to the executive branch?
Some would say this is some kind of mission creep for my organization. And some of you even said that this kind of personal financial transparency is mission creep because it's maybe not technically campaign finance, but it's in the realm of transparency itself. I know that a lot of members have made the FOIA thing a serious part, and it's a part of bringing sunshine to the state of Michigan. I don't have any really good information about how robust that law is going to be. I know that the argument I've heard from some is that governments in deliberation, the legislators need to be able to have conversations that aren't always put out there. And so the counter argument from a transparency minded person is that, well, there's a FOIA coordinator whose sole job is to weigh the balances of, does this information need to be public or does it need to be undisclosed for the sake of privacy or for the sake of deliberations or whatnot?
There's a couple strong models sitting out there. My client, Progress Michigan, has drafted a strong lobbying reform law and a strong FOIA reform law. So there's models out there. Let me ask this, is way beyond your and MCFN's wheelhouse. If these other reforms don't take place, FOIA, lobbying, or even people think that the Prop 1 package is too weak, do you think there's any prospect of somebody pushing a ballot proposal next year and let citizens just take it into their own hands? Heard any talk of that?
I certainly have. The organization Voters Not Politicians did go around and have a town hall series like they did before the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. And they spoke with people about what they think about campaign finance and potential reforms. I attended one of the first of their town halls and reported on it. A lot of interesting conversation, not a lot of specifics about where they might go forward, but we know the power of Voters Not Politicians to have a ground game and one of the only organizations that actually could put together 600,000 plus signatures on a ballot petition. So if I've seen more groups take a position and start talking about campaign finance, and MCFN did report when a couple of groups got together and did a citizen lobby day at the Michigan Capitol. There were no bills on the table, but they indicated that they think that campaign finance reform should be something that their legislators should take up. But you never know in this time, having a state like Michigan that does have ballot proposals, if an organization like Voters Not Politicians will make it their next petition drive.
Certainly every poll that's been done on those topics, lobby reform, FOIA reform, campaign finance reform, comes out very popular. Obviously, the devil is in the details, but at least conceptually, to the public wants, and I think such ballot proposals would be popular. I think you could get the signatures for them, but it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out. So what's in the future for the Campaign Finance Network? You're working on this package of bills, trying to be a voice there. Have other projects, other initiatives that you're working on or thinking about for the future?
We're always going to continue being an educational resource for campaign finance related information, transparency related information here specific to Michigan, to the public, policymakers alike. Next year is a pretty important year for our topic. So I know that a lot of our coverage is going to shift on what's going on in the national picture, as well as keeping focus specifically what's going on here in Michigan. We're looking at a couple of advancements and bringing some more robust tools to our website. As you all know, it's pretty difficult to get campaign finance information about our state legislature and compile it. You can look at individual statements and whatnot, and we're hoping to bring some more robust tools to the website. And so we're looking at a few different of those things and continuing to be that resource for people who want more information about this.
Can you give our listeners your website address? And I think you're on Twitter, or X now, as they call it. Is there a way our listeners can get more information about MCFN and perhaps even follow you on social media?
Absolutely. So our website is mcfn.org, stands for Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Let me ensure that our Twitter is at MichiganCFN, and you can always follow me, the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, at Nicholas Pigeon.
Nick Pigeon, Michigan Campaign Finance Network, thank you so much for joining A Republic If You Can Keep It.
That's all for this week. Our great thanks to Nick Pigeon for his insight into the battle over a more open political system in Michigan, and hopefully your scandals growing out of the secrecy that pervades state government today.
And our thanks to you for giving us a few minutes of your day. If the Republic is still standing, we'll return next week.
A Republic If You Can Keep It with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.